calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends. As we say, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. I could use some myself right now. Just back from a trip to San Diego, where I gave a speech in a workshop over the weekend, and air travel just is not the fun it used to be. Maybe it's that I'm getting old, I don't know, but boy, does my back hurt. Anyway, welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Monday, the 7th of March. Special greetings. We're back in the Santa Fe, Los Alamos market. Special greetings to our listeners on KRSN, which is carrying our program now. Bill O'Reilly will be also on, but a little later in the day. So if you would like to call in and say hi, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. And great to hear from you. And greetings to everybody else. The Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean, writes Kathy Barks Hoffman in the Associated Press, and conservative commentator Pat Buchanan say they're concerned about the growing federal deficit and the movement of American jobs overseas. These two guys, I mean, this is like the odd fellow, right? They're the odd couple, rather. It's Howard Dean and Pat Buchanan. As I've mentioned before on this program, in the months before the election, I read Pat Buchanan's book, Where the Right Went Wrong. I thought, well, this is interesting. And I have to say, it's a book I think every conservative should read, because it is a conservative critique of the Bush administration and their policies. I think liberals, progressives, middle of the road, I think it's a book everyone should read. Here I am endorsing a Pat Buchanan book. I never thought that day would come. I disagree with Pat on a lot of things, but this is really an excellent book, Where the Right Went Wrong. Anyhow, these two guys, they spoke to 1,000 people at a $125 a plate fundraising dinner for Michigan State University's Michigan Political Leadership Program. They disagreed on many issues, notes the Associated Press, but reached agreement on more than a few. Buchanan, and see, this indicates the fracturing, the splintering that's going on in the Republican Party. I'm telling you, there is a battle right now going on, which is not publicized and not discussed in the press. Neither one of these. There is a battle going on, a all-out, full-bore, full-tilt boogie warfare going on in the Republican Party for control of the heart and soul of the Republican Party, and in the Democratic Party for control of the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And on the Republican side, it's the old-fashioned conservatives, what you might call the Barry Goldwater Republicans, the Everett Dirksen Republicans, and they're joining up, in many cases, with the moderates, what you might call the Eisenhower Republicans, against what they consider to be the extremists, the neocons, George W. Bush and his gang, who, you know, are driving the country into massive deficits with these massive tax cuts, the tax cuts accounting for about half of the total deficit. And foreign adventures in foreign lands. I mean, this is something the Republican Party has always been, since its inception before the Civil War, has always been the party of pay attention to what's going on here in America. And if the rest of the world wants to follow our example, fine. And if they don't, tough luck. In fact, the Republicans used to refer to World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War as those Democrat wars. Because Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy were all Democrats, and they essentially started these four wars. So, you'd have to go back to the Spanish-American War and McKinley to find a Republican involved in something like this. And there are still a lot of those folks out there in the Republican Party, and they're very concerned about what's going on. And they very much want to take their party back, and they very much believe that moral values doesn't just mean, although they may agree with it, doesn't just mean waging war against gays, essentially, and abortion. There are a lot of conservative Republicans, people of reasonably good conscience, who believe that moral values include things like caring for the weak among us, providing some sort of social safety. Now, there's a lot of debate within the Republican Party about what it should be. Of course, these extremists in the Bush administration believe there should be none. They are all about rolling back the New Deal entirely. There's some Republicans who are uncomfortable with that, shall we say. Although, frankly, I don't think Buchanan is among them. But in any case, here, they disagreed on many issues but reached agreement on more than a few. Buchanan, this from the Associated Press, Buchanan said the nation must do something to stem its growing federal deficit. The White House projects that this year's deficit will hit $427 billion, a record partly driven by wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Isn't that sweet? Here's the Associated Press. They're giving us the news. The deficit is going to be $427 billion, and they say Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq and Afghanistan aren't even budget items. They're not included in that budget. They're off budget. They're not included in that deficit figure. The tax cuts for the rich account for about half of that tax of that deficit figure. But for some reason, the Associated Press chooses not to tell us that. Anyhow, as Pat Buchanan says, he says, I think we're on an inexorable and very dangerous path. Buchanan repeated his ongoing criticism of trade agreements, saying they were costing American jobs. These are the old-fashioned Republicans. He's saying what is taking place is a betrayal of the American worker. NAFTA and GATT are sending your factories all over the world. Buchanan said of the North American Free Trade Agreement and General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which became or gave birth to the World Trade Organization. Buchanan noted that 2.7 million American manufacturing jobs have disappeared just since George Bush took office. And then they go on to say, Dean and Buchanan held a similar event Friday morning in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The money will be used to support 24 fellowships awarded to aspiring political leaders who go through the leadership program. The Republican Party going through some serious changes here. They've got all the power. They have all the power now. And how are they going to use it? What sort of legacy are they going to leave? Are they going to survive this battle? And the Democratic Party is also going through an incredible struggle right now. You've got the old line Democrats with the old affiliations with labor, for example, the Democratic Party thinking of itself as the party of the people. And then you have the Clinton faction, for lack of a better phrase. Speaking of Bill Clinton, I'm assuming Hillary is part of this. As I've said several times here, I haven't yet been able to figure out where she's at. It's not an indictment or anything. It's just, you know, there's not enough information yet for me to really have formed an opinion. But certainly Bill Clinton, I mean, and this was a very reasonable thing to do, by the way, back in 1990. Seeing that the war against organized labor, when Reagan came into office, 25% of Americans were members of unions and had good jobs and could pay all their health care benefits were taken care of. They could put their kids through college. They had a retirement pension. Roughly half of all American workers, because a quarter of American workers were union members. And for every union job, there's another job that is roughly equal in terms of pay and benefits, because the union jobs define the competitive marketplace for labor. Well, that half of Americans, that 25% of union jobs, once from the time Reagan declared war on organized labor when he first came into office until today, is down to about, I think the last number I saw in this morning's paper, 7.6% of the private workforce is unionized. And so, of course, we've seen the destruction of the middle class. Well, as that happened, one of the major sources of cash for the Democratic Party traditionally had been unions. Unions had membership fees, and they had advertising budgets and whatnot, and they would and political action committees, and they would contribute to Democratic candidates, just like corporations were contributing to Republican candidates. By and large, of course, I'm generalizing here, but it's a pretty safe generalization. And as the Republicans were having success in their all-out war against the American middle class and organized labor, there were two reasons they were doing this. One, they They really believe that you should have a hierarchy, an aristocracy, a landed aristocracy, where basically the rich control everything. And you can't trust the rabble, to quote John Adams, one of the earliest conservatives in American politics. So, number one, they wanted to get rid of the unions just because they didn't think that lowly workers should have anything to say. They should have, you know, just shut up and do your job, is sort of the Republican point of view. It's fine for capital to organize. It's fine for businesses to organize into trade associations. They can create unions. But, you know, workers? But the secondary effect, and the Republicans are very clear about this, is a great benefit, was that if they could kill off unions in the United States, they would kill off a source of funding for the Democratic Party. And they did, to a significant extent. And so in the early 1990s, Bill Clinton and a bunch of other Democrats got together, Bob Schrum and this whole bunch, and they said, what are we going to do? You know, the unions can't provide enough money to run a national campaign against the huge kinds of dollars that were coming in. And this all harkens back to that 1978 Supreme Court decision, Boston versus Bilotti, where the Supreme Court ruled on a 5-4 basis, which is why it's so important who's on the Supreme Court, because they could have ruled the other way very easily. One vote would have flipped that thing. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that corporations are persons, that they have the right to speak, that they have the right to speak about politics, and that because a corporation doesn't have a mouth, that money is their mouth. And this 1978 decision kicked open the doors to the massive corruption of the political machine, as it were, particularly the Republican Party, starting with Reagan in 1980. I mean, it made the whole Reagan phenomena possible. And Clinton looks at this 10 years later and says, you know, all this corporate money's going to the Republicans. We ought to get some of it. And they start the Democratic Leadership Council, the New Democrats. Tony Blair does the same thing in the UK, calls it New Labour. And so you've got this faction of the Democratic Party that actually largely controlled the Democratic Party through most of the 90s that really is Republican light. And now they're becoming increasingly marginalized, and they're, in fact, Barack Obama, they just came out, the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council, just came out with their list of the top 100 Democratic politicians to keep your eye on, and Barack Obama was on the list, and Obama says to them, take me off the list. I don't want to be affiliated with you guys. Come on, give me a break. So there's this battle going on in the Democratic Party between the Republican-light DLC and the old-line Democrats who say, hey, let's get back to our roots. It's fascinating to watch all this stuff play out. Absolutely fascinating. And in just a minute, I'll share with you how Rick Santorum is playing his role in these wars. Interesting stuff. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousand...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Will you come down from your ivory tower? You will see how it really would be.
And welcome back. Now we're not in our ivory tower here. It's back behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. High up in the green mountains of the... Or is it the White Mountains? It's the Green Mountains of the People's Republic of Vermont. White Mountains are over in New Hampshire, as I recall. I've lived in both states, and so I get them all confused. 25 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Pennsylvania's Rick Santorum is... Now, you've got Ted Kennedy out here saying, let's raise the minimum wage by a couple bucks. Let's take it back to the purchasing power it had in the 1960s. In the 1960s. Kennedy's actually not talking about a real raise in the minimum wage in terms of its purchasing power, because you've had inflation all these years. But he's saying, you know, let's take it up to, you know, $7, $8, $9. I don't have the exact number in front of me here, but Kennedy's raise is about a $2.50, $2.80 raise, something like that. Would take the minimum wage up to the point where basically it was 35, 40 years ago in terms of purchasing power. Because it's steadily eroded, because throughout the Reagan administration, throughout the Bush senior administration, and through this Bush administration, there's been no increase in the minimum wage. I mean, it's just, it's anathema to Republicans to do this, or to conservatives, let's say. By the way, here's a quick fix for the Social Security problem that has been now shared with us by several people in different analyses. Simply raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour nationwide. And the added money that will be paid into the Social Security Trust Fund, because so much of it is paid by people at the bottom end of the labor scale, will solve the problem. In fact, back during the Reagan administration, when they raised the Social Security tax to create the trust fund and they moved back the retirement age, they thought they had solved the problem forever, because they were assuming that the minimum wage would increase over time as inflation cut into its purchasing value. That was one of their economic assumptions. Well, if you simply did that, you wouldn't have a Social Security problem. Anyhow, Santorum is saying, well, yeah, cool. Let's raise the minimum wage by $1.10 an hour. Now, that's going to get the attention of all the working class voters in Pennsylvania, right? And of course, keep in mind, this is a guy who wants to run for president in 3 years. But there's a few gotchas. These are called poison pills. $1, this from the Economic Policy Institute analysis. In fact, I got this off NathanNewman.org, the labor blog. Although it's all over, the Center for American Progress has it, and of course the Economic Policy Institute has it. Exempt, and I believe I saw that Paul Krugman wrote something about this today. It will exempt any business with revenues of $1 million or less from regulation. So that means 1.2 million workers will qualify for a minimum wage increase, but another 6.8 million workers, they write on Labor Blog, who work for companies with revenues between $500,000 and $1 million a year will lose their current minimum wage protection. And an even larger number of businesses, those with revenues under $7 million, would be exempt from fines under a range of other safety, health, pension, and other labor laws. So it's like, throw the dog a bone, but let's steal his dinner plate. It gets worse, notes Nathan Newman's labor blog. The 40-hour work week would be abolished, and companies would not have to pay overtime if they cut hours the next week. As they call this flex time, but the workers, it's not flexible for the workers, it's entirely up to the management. Their hours can be rearranged, upsetting child care and other weekly routines. Santorum's bill would also ban states from requiring employers to pay tipped workers with a guaranteed wage. If you're a waiter, your employer now, in most places, you've got to be paid at least $2.25. Now you can be paid, or $2.13, that's federal law. Now you can be paid nothing. You just get to work for tips. He adds, if Santorum and the GOP can push through a restriction on states' ability to raise standards for tipped workers, the next step could easily be a restriction on states being allowed to have any minimum wage higher than the federal level at all. This, in the guise of a $1.10 an hour raise in the minimum wage, Rick Santorum is attempting to destroy the last shreds of labor protection. What a surprise. 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad...
Tyler, we've been over this 3 times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
From overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space.
And welcome back. 27 minutes past the hour, or before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Terry, a truck driver on the road. Hey, Terry, where on the road are you?
I'm in New Mexico right now.
Oh, great state. What's up?
Well, I just want to say I've been back from Iraq for about 4 months now. I'm a truck driver in the Army Reserves.
Uh-huh.
And don't get many newspapers over there, but I've been reading the newspapers lately when I got back, and I've been listening to you and all the other people, and you guys are wearing out this Social Security stuff. I think you guys need to go back and start looking at, the Iraq war. It's like like I was telling the guy that answers the phone, I was looking at the newspaper, and they're pushing the Iraq war all the way back into the fifth page now.
Yeah, I know. It's GIs dying don't even make the fifth page. They're on the 12th page, and that's a tragedy.
Tell me, like the USA Today, that's the only newspaper I can get out here that, you know, has everything.
Yeah.
And they pushed it back to the fifth page, and it's like they're all worried about the Social Security. But honestly, I think Bush is using Social Security as a smokescreen, because once the war started going bad for him, what popped up? Social Security. I mean,
He had to change the subject as quickly as he could, in other words.
Yeah. He popped up Social Security, and, you know, and then you hear, like, behind closed doors, he wants to raise up, you know, the death pay for a soldier from $10,000 to $200,000.
Uh-huh.
Or from $12,000, excuse me.
Right.
Well, now, my main question is, are all the guys that have died, is their family members, are they going to get the raise if it happens? Are they going to get the reimbursement for it?
Well, my question is it even going to happen?
honestly, I don't think it's going to happen. As long as Bush is in there, I don't think it's going to happen.
I mean, he just cut his new budget, has huge cuts for the Veterans Administration.
And, oh, yeah. I couldn't believe it. When I came back, I mean, I'm an owner-operator, I own my own truck. And when I came back, I had letters in the mail saying that I was behind on my truck payment. I was behind on this. I was behind on that. Well, we get nothing. When we come back in the reserve, it's nothing. It's like when we came back, they had Army doctors and stuff standing around at the airport.
Yeah.
And you probably heard this, but I got a big R painted on my chest. And when they asked me, are you a reservist or are you active duty? And I said, no, I'm a reservist. They said, please step over here. And they attended to the guys that were active duty. We got pushed off into a corner at the airport.
Yeah, so the reservists are very much second-class citizens. This is something that's really angering a lot of states. In fact, I've got several Iraq stories in the stack for the 3 hours of our program today. One of them that the governor of, I believe it is Montana, I don't have the story right in front of me, it's buried down in the pile here, has now... I believe he's a Republican, has said to Bush that he would appreciate it if Bush would send back his National Guard guys, because they're having such a drought here in the spring that they're expecting major wildfires this summer, and they're going to need them to fight the wildfires.
Let me just toss in
one thing here, Terry. I thought it was really interesting when the hurricanes hit the hit Florida. We had four or five of them there in a row. I thought it was real interesting that the Florida National Guard was not in Iraq. They were all right there in Florida. It's like, you know, Jeb's got some pull. He can get his National Guard guys home, but apparently nobody else can.
Let me ask you one thing, Tom. What does National Guard stand for?
Guarding the nation. There you go.
They are supposed to be for homeland security in case there's an uprise or something, a fire, hurricane.
Yep.
They're supposed to be kept in the United States.
Yeah, they're the remnant of the original militia that was set up that George Washington commanded. They put down the Whiskey Rebellion, you know.
You're very right. And where are they now? They're over there.
Yeah, it makes no sense. The National Guard, this is why when George W. Bush joined the National Guard during Vietnam, he knew he wouldn't go to Vietnam because none of the people in that National Guard unit went to Vietnam. In fact, the planes that they were flying were not even being used in combat anymore. They were obsolete. It was basically, you know, keep these guys busy, and if Texas ever gets attacked, we can use these old planes to fight back Mexico. But
And one other question. I'm coming up for reenlistment here in about 6 months.
Yes, sir, Terry.
I want your personal opinion. I've already talked to my wife, and she doesn't really want me to reenlist. But do you think that, like the Republicans said, a lot of guys aren't reenlisting, and the recruiting rate has gone down so bad that they can't recruit anybody?
Yeah, well, they're having a challenge.
Have said that anybody that doesn't reenlist. Now, I heard this on a program on another station. Just happened to flip the channel, and I heard it. A Republican said that if you don't reenlist, you're a coward. You're a yelly-belly coward, and you need to be taken out and slapped around for being a coward because you won't reenlist.
There was one of these right-wing talk show hosts who made that comment last week. We had a caller on it, yeah. That's absurd. I mean, to say that somebody who has done their service to this country, and I mean, over and above and beyond their service to this country, because we're not required to have military service here. So somebody who's volunteered has helped out, has gone over to Iraq, to say that that there's anything wrong with their not reenlisting is nuts. Is nuts. And the response to that talk show host would be, okay, if you're so gung ho, go enlist. Do your show from Baghdad.
I tried to call him up. But when I got online, I told him, they said, well, we only have 2 minutes left. Sorry. Boom. Bye.
Yeah. Now, these right wingers, usually they screen their calls and they filter out the what they call negative calls or whatever they call it. We don't hear, like, by the way. I like people who disagree with me, but that's a whole other thing.
You know, over there, what I did is I drove around gas tankers.
Yeah.
I had a big old Target on my back.
Yeah.
I mean, I had 55,000 gallons of gas.
Phew.
And we got shot at, and we were told when we got shot at, you know, we got out of the vehicles. When we, over there, you don't slow down. I mean, we hit a car, you keep going. I mean, it's 80 miles an hour over there. You don't slow down for nothing. And it's getting so bad over there that, you know, you can't even haul stuff around anymore. The way they're blowing up vehicles and stuff.
I know. It is a bad situation. Bush never should have gotten us into this. Terry, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I appreciate your listening. And I just have to say, I salute you. You know, you're a great patriot, and I salute you. And there is nothing less than honorable about saying, okay, I've done my service, I'm not going to reenlist. That's just fine. Bill in California on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I think purchaser of this Sirius fancy radio here, and thank God it's kind of saved my soul. I've been a registered Democrat since the mid-60s. I spent purposely a year listening to Rush Limbaugh, and I spent purposely a year listening to Bill O'Reilly. I'm 6 months into Tony Snow, but I can't last it.
good on you.
Yeah, but I try, and the reason is I'm in a very red county, and there was absolutely no access to any of you folks unless I buy this thing, and I'm so glad. My wife said I was going crazy if I didn't get this raise.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to last much longer. I found so many inconsistencies, and I listen for that length of time and start jotting down notes.
What's your point, Bill? Pardon my interrupting, but.
Yeah, no, the point I was trying to make, first of all, is thank you, because what you're saying makes a lot of sense, especially when you're describing the impact that Democrats have had on different wars and how Republicans have stolen so much of our fuel. One of the things is that I've always thought of Republicans or conservatives is they tend to walk down. And in doing that, they tend to hang on to things that liberals created.
I'm sorry, part of your words got faded out. They tend to do what?
Well, they tend to walk backwards into the future, and
backwards.
Try very hard to hang on to things that liberals created.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and take credit for them. Now, you got George Bush running ads with Franklin Roosevelt's face in them, you know, mentioning Franklin Roosevelt in his speeches. He's got Roosevelt's grandson so mad he's writing op-ed pieces.
and they continually grab on to Kennedy, and they don't realize whatever liberal or conservative is was relative to the time in which it took place. But the other thing, I would like to see the Democrats start to focus more on what it is we can do, what it is our future can be.
I agree, Bill, and I think that they are. And again, I'm not a Democrat, and I'm not a consultant to the Democrats or any. I have no affiliation whatsoever with the Democratic Party. And in 2000, I voted for Republican Jim Jeffords, I voted for Democrat Pat Leahy, I voted for an Independent Ralph Nader. This was 4 years ago. This time I voted for Kerry, but I am certifiably about as independent as you can get, and I would like to see the Democrats start to get their act together. And I think it's happening, because Howard Dean does have a vision for America, and it is a very moderate, rational vision. I mean, Howard Dean is what used to be referred to, or when he was governor of this state.
You remember the motto that Robert Kennedy used during his campaign?
Which one?
Which is, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Yeah, we're paraphrasing George Bernard Shaw, actually.
Yeah, Bernard Shaw. And I wish that mantra was back out.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling it's coming. Bill, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate the call. And this is the time. And there, I'm telling you, there are some extraordinary candidates, some extraordinary people coming out. One of the things that Louise and I have talked about doing with the program here is perhaps even getting some of these Democratic candidates or independents or Greens or whatever on and doing, you know, kind of coaching them through their candidacies. We've been fiddling around with this idea. as part of our Tools for Activism thing. Just to slightly change the topic, but really not, because this is really about politics. On this flight back, I started the program by mentioning that my back is killing me because I spent, 10 hours on airplanes getting home from San Diego. You got to fly from San Diego to Chicago and then quack, quack, quack. So anyhow, leave there in the morning, get here. I got here last night about 11:30 p.m. And the guy that I sat next to on the plane, I fly enough. You get these, frequent flyer miles and upgrade certificates and all this stuff. So I paid for a coach seat, but I got bumped up to first class. And I'm sitting next to this guy in first class, and he's very loquacious, very chatty guy. And he starts asking me what I do for a living, and I really don't like to talk about that to people on airplanes. So I just, I just turn it right around and say, what do you do for a living? And people always love to talk about themselves. He completely forgot that I never answered his question. Went off on this long screed, and he worked for a credit card company. And he supervised 3,000 people in Bombay who answered the phones and did the back office accounting for one of America's largest credit card companies. And so I started asking him, how do you guys make your money? Where's the profit center for the credit card companies? Because I see your interest rates are really cranking up. And he's like, well, with the interest rates, we're keeping the interest rates to the point where we can make a modest profit on the interest rate on the credit card. But mostly it covers losses. He said where we're our real profit center, the real major and growing profit center, because they're worried about regulation from Congress if the interest rates get out of line. The major growing profit center, he said, is fees. He said you wouldn't believe how sloppy most Americans are. He said probably two-thirds, three-quarters of the people that have our credit card, they pay their bill a day or two late. And bang, we hit them 25, 35 bucks in fees. Plus, we get to raise the interest rates because we can show now that they're bad credit risks. And I said, but, haven't you gone from a month down to like 2.5 weeks to, the time that you've got to pay, which means basically you've got to pay if you don't pay in the same week that you get the bill, you're going to be hit with a fee. And he chuckled and he said, yeah, we did that. And it's been very profitable. The industry just had its most profitable year ever. And this guy's like, he's really bragging to me about this stuff, and I mean, what can I say? I mean, he's a fellow human being. I wasn't going to jump down his throat about it, but I'm sitting there thinking, I couldn't sleep at night if that's what I did for a living. And all the jobs that they're taking with them to India and whatnot. I mean, it's just so. Anyhow, here we have in the Washington Post, Senate's going to vote this week on a bill that would make it harder for individuals to wipe out debt through bankruptcy, and this is being pushed by the credit card companies. And they, for example, Cleveland Municipal Judge Robert Triozzi said last fall when he ruled against Discover in the company's breach of contract suit against Ruth Owens, how is a person who wants to do right ends up so worse off? He asked the question. Well, here's the story of Ruth Owens. She tried for 6 years to pay off a $1,900 balance on her Discover card, sending the credit card company, a total of $3,492 in monthly payments between 1997 and 2003. She ran up a $1,900 bill. Now, the credit card companies also charge the merchants a couple of percentage points as well, by the way. They're making money on both sides. You use your credit card, and that merchant has to pay the credit card company, too. Anyhow, she $1,900 balance. She paid the credit card company $3,492. And yet her balance grew to $5,564.28, even though she never used the card to buy anything after that initial $1,900. The fees alone were $1,158. You get this? She bought $1,900 worth of stuff. She paid the credit card company $3,492, and she still owed them $5,564. This is loan sharking. This isn't a credit card industry. This is loan sharking. And now Santorum and Lott and Bill Frist and Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert, they want to say, this happens to you? Tough luck. You can't declare bankruptcy anymore. How dare you? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Hutch from East Tennessee on the line. Hey, Hutch, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I don't want to change the subject off credit and everything because I know that's real important.
Well, that's okay. We've only got about a minute here, Touch, so let's get to it quickly.
All right. Well, out here in East Tennessee, I know you know a little bit about history and stuff. The newspaper that we get, I just noticed since I moved here from a big city that we don't get a lot of information that a lot of people get in larger cities. And it's just like omitted.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the history, a little bit about the history of how that...
Well, the reason for that is that newspapers operate on what's called the 60-40-40-60 rule, which means that you don't ever want your advertising to represent more than 60% or less than 40% of the total amount of space in the newspaper. So small towns, they can't sell a lot of ads, they don't have a lot of pages. I mean, that's basically the bottom line. Hutch, you got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza man.
Hey, you're not the pizza man. You're the cable guy again.
Price patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ooh, by powder. Ooh, for his greed.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, just like Reagan, like Bush, you know, appointing people to cabinet positions who have said that they don't believe that the department should even exist. And there's a long history of that. The anti-environmentalists to the EPA and, Ann Veneman, head of the Cattlemen's Association to the USDA. In any case, here we have now John Bolton. Has been appointed the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. A few quotes from John Bolton back in 1994. He said, quote, "There's no such thing as the United Nations. If the U.N. Secretary building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference." Yes, this is our new ambassador. Many Republicans in Congress, said John Bolton, and perhaps a majority, not only do not care about losing the General Assembly vote, but actually see it as a make-my-day outcome. Indeed, once the vote is lost, and the adverse consequences predicted by the UN supporters begin to occur, this will simply provide further evidence to many why more should be paid to the UN system. John Bolton, cynical remark he's making on October 24th, 1998. So here we've got a guy who hates the UN. He's going to be our new ambassador to the UN. What a surprise. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Dale in Southeast Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Dale, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. I really appreciate your show and your books, particularly Unequal Protection, which I think was great.
Thank you.
I want to get right to the point. I love what you do with the language by not calling the conservatives conservatives, because I really don't think they are. And I like you to use loan sharking and usury like you've been doing too.
Yeah, so, although increasingly so many people are calling themselves conservatives because the Limbaughs of the world have rebranded that word, that I do have to use it from time to time so that we can define the terms. But in any case, as you were saying.
Well, I want to make another real brief point that the illustration of corporate personhood, how a corporation can keep operating and buying other companies when it's bankrupt and a individual citizen can't. I'd like your comment on that.
Well, it's very simple. I mean, the bankruptcy law, there have been a number of bankruptcy reforms over the last 15, 20 years, but, you know, since Reagan by and large. And in all cases, they have made it harder for human beings to avoid debts. And now we have a situation where more than half of all bankruptcies are the result of medical disasters that people have. And the cons are saying, and the conservatives, the Republicans in particular, but there are some Democrats who are signing on for this because they're taking money from the banks and the credit card companies, and they're saying, well, you know, tough luck. That's it, you know, tough luck. And then there have been a number of reforms that have made it a whole lot easier for corporations to declare bankruptcy and continue doing business. So that's, you know, it's a different set of rules for different people. It's just very, very straightforward. Dale, I appreciate your call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut.
He's the man. man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And speaking of the American middle class and the war being waged against it by conservatives in general and Republicans in particular, although there's a few conservative Democrats in on this, here we have now labor. This is in the Los Angeles Times, article by David K. Shipler. Why Republicans should love unions, he says. Unions have almost disappeared from the private sector, where they represent merely 7.9% of workers. That's in the private sector. This is the lowest level of union membership in the United States since the Great Depression. And a lot of people are, you know, a lot of working people out there are scratching their heads going, why does it feel like the Great Depression all over again? Why do we have to have three jobs just to pay the rent? Why do I, myself and my wife and everybody put the kids to work? I mean, why is it like that? Well, there you go. If you don't have unions, you don't have the balance between the power of corporate power and the potential power of labor power. It isn't, the cons have gotten so good at this reframing. They've completely reframed it to say, well, companies give you jobs. No, they don't give you jobs. Companies have things they want made so that they can make a profit. And they want to make a profit off your labor. And if your labor costs $20 an hour, let's say, after all is said and done, and they can't earn $30 or $40 or $50 from that hour's worth of labor, then they're not going to hire you, and if they can, they will. So you're contributing to corporate profits by working for them. It's very simple. Oh, they're giving us jobs. Yeah, right. Anyhow, we have what we don't have. Hey, we lost him off line six there, Rama. You got to get David back on. We had David Swanson with the International Labor Communications Association. He'll be back in just a minute. Anyhow, as David Shipler says, Republicans who believe that the source of economic well-being is the private sector, not government programs, cannot shrink government in a just way until the private sector functions well for workers at the bottom rung of our society. And that won't happen until employers pay higher wages and benefits. And they won't do that until the market requires that, and the market won't make that demand until workers can level a playing field with their employers through collective bargaining. A workplace works freely. A marketplace works freely only when both sides of the transaction have negotiating power. Not something the Greenspans of the world want. David is back with us. David Swanson, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, a member of the board of directors of the Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org is the Progressive Democrats, ilcaonline.org, the International Labor Communications Association. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
It's great having you on here on a semi-regular basis here to talk about these labor issues. It continually boggles my mind. I was in San Diego over the weekend and gave a speech Friday night and did a workshop on Saturday on grassroots activism and communication tools, NLP tools and whatnot for progressive activists. And sitting in my hotel room, I watched the news. I mean, I try and keep up on stuff, and I'm watching the various networks. And I'm getting all this business news. I know what the stock market is. I know what the interest rates are. I know that the credit card companies just had one of their most profitable years ever. I know, you know, all this. I don't have a clue from watching network television and cable television news. I don't have a clue what's going on with labor in America. So I think it's really important that we have these conversations and we inform people. The AFL-CIO Executive Council just had a meeting in Las Vegas. Is it still going on, or did it just wrap up?
No, it ended at the end of the week.
Yeah, that was what I thought. It was last week. And, of course, there will be a convention in Chicago in July. You were there, were you not?
I will be there in Chicago. I was not in Las Vegas.
Oh, okay.
I was
okay. Yeah,
I've been in New York.
Okay, but as the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, I'm sure you've got your finger on the pulse of this whole thing. What were some of the proposals from international unions in the state and federal and constituency groups like yourself, the ILCA? What were some of the proposals that were put forth at the AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting?
Well, as you know, there's been this unprecedented internal public debate within labor for the past better part of a year, since last summer, and the SEIU pushed for big changes and threatened to pull out of the AFL-CIO, the single biggest union.
Yeah, and Tony, what's his last name?
Andy Stern.
Andy Stern, thank you, that's right. Andy Stern of the people talking about this guy. This guy's amazing. That he's an absolutely amazing, you know, his charisma, a charismatic leader.
He's a great speaker. I've met him. I've heard him speak at events. He's an excellent speaker, and he's got some powerful ideas, and he's got a willingness to speak out and not hold his tongue, and that's often needed sometimes.
Yeah.
He's got ideas that some other unions like and some don't like, and so for the past several months, there have been these proposals from each international union, from state federations, from constituency groups, and they're all on the AFL-CIO website, on the SEIU website, and on the ILCA website. And the two big things that the SEIU began pushing for that have sort of dominated the debate are cutting in half the money that each union gives the AFL-CIO, taking that back and using it for organizing by the union.
At a local level?
At a national or local level, but by the particular union, the SEIU,
right,
or the machinists or the communications workers, not
UFCW,
the AFL-CIO, the big federation.
Right.
And the other proposal has been to force mergers on unions, and it's now been toned down by most parties to encourage mergers by unions, to try to get to a single union per industry, to have supposedly better bargaining power. And so what happened in Las Vegas was that seven unions, including the SEIU and the Teamsters and others, moved a proposal to on the 50% cut in dues to the AFL, and that failed. And President John Sweeney of the AFL-CIO moved a proposal to double the amount of money the AFL-CIO spends on political stuff and on legislative campaigns, as well as to devote more to organizing. And that passed.
Right. Now, why do you think the cutting the amount of money that is going to the AFL from the local unions and dedicating that to local organizing efforts, why do you think that failed?
I think it failed because it was an extreme amount, 50%. It would have required the AFL-CIO to lay off a couple of hundred people, to gut many of its programs, to eliminate many of the services that it does provide to its constituent member unions. I think that part of the motivation behind proposing that was to really shake things up and to have people thrown out and to bust up a bureaucracy that Mr. Stern is not happy with.
To the extent that may have been his actual goal, was that accomplished?
Well, not yet, and pretty much nothing has been decided, and everything will be decided in July in Chicago. The several unions that were pushing that proposal have said that they will continue to try to win a majority before Chicago. And, you know, in addition to that and the other controversial issues that will have to be settled in Chicago, there may be a contested election for the leadership of the AFL-CIO. So there's a lot to be decided this summer.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. Where do you think this debate is going? I mean, are even the right questions being debated?
I don't think so. I think that you can make either argument. We need to organize so we have strength for politics, or we need to focus on politics so that we have the right to organize and the laws aren't blocking organization. You know, both of those make sense, but we're going about both of them in the wrong way. And in politics, we're not being aggressive enough, and we're not engaging and activating our members enough. And the same in organizing. We're not doing workplace organizing by fellow workers, and we're not organizing communities into a social movement. We're not being aggressive. And what's being largely left out is communications.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's in some of the proposals. The machinists have advocated for creating a cable network, you know, but in labor, our two pillars of communication are futile PR efforts and spending hundreds of millions of dollars of working people's money on hopeless political campaigns, where we have the resources, if we choose, to support independent media outlets, to create new independent media outlets, broadcast and print, and have workers' issues covered honestly and accurately day in and day out.
For example, by independent media, what do you mean?
Well, I mean outside of these mega conglomerates that control most of the broadcast, much of the cable, and much of the radio.
Are you suggesting labor should start, like, buying radio and TV stations?
Or? Well, absolutely. I think that, and the ILCA has a proposal for this on the top of our website that will be moved at our convention and moved from the floor of the AFL convention if it passes at ours. And we need to take Central Labor Council newspapers and expand them to a broader audience in an entire city, including non-unionized workers. We need to create a new cable network, create a new radio network, work with independent media outlets like the Tom Hartman Show that are covering labor, give them resources. Yeah. And we need to establish labor media on a scale bigger even than what was seen 40 years ago.
Now, David, we're talking with David Swanson, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association. We only have about a minute and a half left. David, for a little over a year, this program was carried on IE America Radio, which was owned by the United Auto Workers. And, you know, it was a radio network. It was the first liberal radio network. And they kind of killed it off by, frankly, you know, looking back on it, by mismanagement, in my opinion. I thought they could have just done incredible things with this, but is labor prepared to make a new commitment to this? I felt like the UAW just was sort of tolerating it, frankly.
Many in labor are eager to make a new commitment, and many still do not get it, including, frankly, the leadership of the AFL-CIO. And the fact is, we will never buy enough advertising to get these stories out there, and we will never come up with the perfect frame and the perfect soundbite that persuades Time Warner and Viacom and the New York Times to want to present workers' issues. So this is the way we have to go, and we have to do it carefully with good management and with the right control from a board, but with the right degree of independence for producers and editors.
If I may humbly suggest, I would suggest that what you should be looking at are individual shows that you can promote from the bottom up, because that's really how the radio business works. This Air America model is a very anomalous thing, and it's an experiment. You know, time will tell. It didn't work for IE, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, good advice.
Yeah, David, thank you so much for being on the program today. It's always good to get the labor perspective every week. And ILCA Online, the website, David Swanson, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
If I could get out of this kidney dialysis, I'd be a free man, but alas.
It's Osama's song.
To follow that cable right down through the middle of Krakistan Pass.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. And, how come we can't find a 6'4" guy on a donkey carrying around a dialysis machine? Good question. Let's ask Ellen Ratner at the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, that's an interesting question. Of course, there's still quite a bit of debate as to whether he's really on dialysis or not.
Yeah, and whether he's still alive.
I mean, for all we know, he could have gotten a kidney transplant.
Yeah. Yeah, by now.
And I'm of the feeling that, that he, at least part of the time, has been in Iran, but I've been wrong before.
That's interesting.
I've certainly heard that opinion from some people in intelligence.
Yeah. Well, it's not like Pakistan is friendly to U.S. territory. I mean, Musharraf is hanging on by his fingernails and
No. But he's our friend, just like who Saddam Hussein was.
Oh yeah, he's a good torturer. He's
okay.
So what's going on in Washington?
Things going on. We were you were on tape on Friday, but we were at an event on Friday and at the Pentagon. And one of the questions that came up is how many people who are involved essentially as contractors or other associated personnel with the military have been injured or died. And right. They will not release those figures.
For the contractors?
That's right.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it that they're not keeping track of it, that they're just saying to Halliburton, okay, you guys know how many of your people have died, but we don't really care?
Very surprised if they don't keep track of it.
Yeah.
And speaking of keeping track of things, I mean, we have this whole thing with this Italian woman who says that, you know, they purposely targeted the car, this, that, and the other. Well, you know, I was at one of the checkpoints near the airport, and I'm not sure which one this all happened at. But
She's saying now that it wasn't a checkpoint at all, that they were simply driving down the street, and it was a sniper attack or a tank or something.
They are saying it was a checkpoint, and they drove through it. Well, it's very simple. For $1,000 a checkpoint in Iraq, we can put cameras up there and good video cameras, and we will have all that information.
Yeah, and if you want cheap video cameras, you can do it for $90 a checkpoint.
Right.
If you get these kind, you know, these home security
ones for about $1,000 a print.
These little home security ones. I mean, actually, I think they're color, and it's just, you know, it's not the best resolution, but
better than 7-Eleven. The things we use for RadioRow.net are about $200. So
yeah.
You get a really good system. You put in, you know, two or three cameras, you'll be all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, then. You have this problem, like with the NBC reporter who filmed the guy shooting the guy in the mosque, you know.
Right.
And the military really doesn't.
You're right.
They really don't want a trail of what's going on over there, and you can understand why. Not that I agree with it, but I can understand why they would not. I mean, you know, war is hell, and things happen that everybody's ashamed of after the fact.
That's right. So we're trying to figure out if any of that information can be gained by Freedom of Information Act on what the Pentagon won't release. But it's very interesting. They won't talk about it, won't release it. Meanwhile, there's something else going on. McCain and Feingold are going to be testifying before the House Senate Rules Committee about their addition of this 527 legislation that they essentially want to cut off the federal the money and make this all federalized, which means you will be limited to $25,000, as I read the legislation, just like you are to political parties. The names will be written, and it will have to be, you know, used for very clear purposes. It's interesting. The liberal groups are opposing this, and the conservative groups want this, a sort of a change in venue. But they're saying, why should their reason is, why should Fox News have a venue, and why shouldn't MoveOn.org have a venue?
Right.
And they're well aware that it's the same kind of issue even with, the Swift boats. But they're saying that they do not want to cut off the money. And this time, McCain-Feingold is not going to be supported by a lot of liberal groups.
Interesting. Because there are no liberal media outlets, major ones. You know, you've got Brian Williams now, the head anchor for NBC, saying publicly that he feels it's part of his job duties, his responsibility, to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. I mean, it's outrageous. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by DemocraticMatch.com and Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com. Small Dog's phone number, 1-800-511-MACS, 1-800-511-MAX. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call into the program, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to drop into the chat room, just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll take you to our message board. Click the chat room there, and it'll drop you right into our chat room. which is well populated with people literally from all over the world. Sue in Milton Keynes in the United Kingdom, and Harriet out there in Washington State, and we have folks, Rama sitting right here in the studio with us, Rama Schneider, who his program on the, you can hear it on the web on GRR Radio, G-R-R. Rama, how many R's are there in that?
Three.
G followed by 3R radio.com. Yes, sir. There you go. Okay. 1-866-889-8894 telephone number. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm betting you're calling to say that I should have reminded David Swanson that the union should refer to themselves as workplace democracy.
Yeah, sort of, and to elaborate a little bit on that. But, yeah, you're right. Since he's the communications guy, they got to learn how to frame language with catchy slogans and repeat it over and over and over to brand it into the American brain, that what they're doing is extending democracy to the workplace. And what it will do is expose the cons' hypocrisy and dishonesty by using their slogans against them. They always talk about spreading democracy, right?
Right. Freedom on the march. Into the workplace.
Yeah. Well, what they are is they're about spreading unregulated capitalism is really what they're about. They're not about spreading voices and distributing power to all participants and citizens.
Yeah, although I don't think that we should call it unregulated capitalism, because capitalism is not considered a dirty word by most Americans. Instead, what we should say is what they're about is absolute power for the wealthiest among us and no power at all for the average worker.
Which is democracy, not socialism. See, they confuse all this. It's democracy spreading the voices to all the people. And he has to mention that over and over, use that word democracy into a place where we spend half of our waking life. Yeah. And the Europeans see it this way, that this is why they have strong unions, because they actually see it like, well, it's extending democracy.
Well, and they refer to their unions as workplace democracy.
Yes. So this is why my wife, who's German, says she doesn't get it why Americans tolerate not having democracy in a place where they spend half their life.
Yeah. Good
and
point,
Tom. Because they don't look at it that way, honey. You know, they don't see it that way.
Yep.
And she says, well, they got to start talking like that.
There you go. I agree with you, Tom. I absolutely agree with you. And thank you very much for calling and making the point. It's excellent. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. It's great to talk to you again since Saturday.
Yeah.
And a shout-out to the chat room. And, by the way, I have a house full of Macintosh computers, about six of them. I get a lot of my stuff through Small Dog, and I'm glad they're advertising on your show.
Great.
I first got involved in the corporate involvement in our politics through the media conglomeration back in the 80s when I studied journalism. And I really disagree. I don't think the left should have to buy radio stations. I think we should reinstitute the fairness doctrine and force the broadcasters to do their jobs, which is give us equal time on both sides. I mean, for every time we have a mouth-breathing Reich-winger on the TV or radio, we should have a balancing view from the left. And I think...
Well, yes and no. I'm sorry I don't agree with you, Scott, because I frankly don't want the government, any government, even a government of, by, and for we the people. I don't want the government coming in and saying, okay, how many hours of your program, Tom Harbin, were devoted to promoting the Democratic Party or the Green Party or the positions on the, and how, you know, and how much of Michael Reagan's program is going to balance my program, and how, who, you know, and well, what's it going to take to balance, Michael Weiner, what's his stage name, Michael Savage, see, what had happened, I was in broadcasting back when the Fairness Doctrine was in effect. I worked in radio from 1968 to 1978. And the Fairness Doctrine went out in 78. In 87. So it was a decade after that. And what happened was we simply didn't talk about politics.
It's Tom, I'm talking about the public airwaves, ABC, NBC.
I agree. Yeah. I'm talking about the public airwaves as well. And we're on public airwaves right now. The vast majority of people listening to this program are listening to them on terrestrial radio stations. Frankly, I'm not in favor of a return to the Fairness Doctrine. What I am in favor of is because the reason why is because I think that the marketplace will ultimately sort it out. What I am in favor of is decentralization, breaking of media, breaking up the big media combines. We have media monopolies in this country. That's not good for democracy. When radio and television stations are once again locally owned, whether they're carrying local programming or national programming, then you're gonna see more democracy, as it were, in the media, in my opinion, because they're going to be more responsive. They're going to have to be more responsive to their local listeners.
I absolutely agree on that.
And I also believe that there should be some sort of Fairness Doctrine kind of thing that says that as a part of your having a license, that you have a requirement to allow politicians to present their case. Because you'll see the media is one of the largest lobbies in Washington, D.C. And the reason why is because they're getting they got $1 trillion in the last election cycle from politicians nationwide. It's a huge I mean, it's like the media are like pigs at the trough for dollars for political campaigns. And that's why they've cut off political debate. If you're if you want to run for office now, the media is not required to give you a soapbox to stand on. You have to buy it. You have to buy your way in with advertising. That's the way they like it. I don't think that should be the case.
That's what I mean. I'm talking about that very subject. We have a local radio station here, really focuses on our local issues. KLSD here in San Diego focuses on our local issues in relationship both to city, state, and federal government.
Sort of. Most of the programming on KLSD is actually national network. It's Air America Radio.
Yes, but I'm talking about the morning program that we have here with our local host.
Yeah, so you've got one program.
And, we've got one program here.
And he does a great job, Stacey Taylor. In fact, I was on his show on Friday.
Yeah.
He does a great job. But it's kind of ironic that here I am, a national talk show host, and I'm saying that I think local radio is really, really important. But I do. I absolutely think it's really important. And I think that if we had a breakup of these giant media monopolies, that you would see a lot more of it. Scott, I appreciate the call, and I got to move along here. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I just thought I'd pass out. There was a couple activists this weekend that wall-to-walled our local art theater and showed Power of Nightmares.
That's incredible.
And it was 100% sellout on donation only.
That's incredible. Now, it's funny because we have a local art theater like that here in Montpelier, Vermont, the Savoy. And they carried, when they ran Fahrenheit 9/11, they had to run an extra few days, and the lines went around the block and things. I mean, it's a theater that probably holds 200 people. And one of the folks in our chat room has been offering DVDs and copies of The Power of Nightmares. And I was thinking of taking it down to them and saying, here, you want to run this thing. But I thought that they would have copyright problems.
I don't know how they got around the copyright problem. And quite frankly, I don't care. It was great. I mean, to watch that thing in full-blown color with this, and it's a mediocre theater. I mean, it's not a
it's a shocking story. Absolutely shocking story.
It is phenomenal. But
they played all 3 hours of it.
The whole 3 hours. And I carried some flyers down, and there was some other people with some flyers. And again, we're spreading the virus. We got to get this thing out.
Got to get the thought. Yeah, get the memes out there. I agree. Roy, by the way, are you listening to us on KRSN now? Today's
our first day. I'm in the office right now, and I can't pick it up because of the fluorescence and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I was listening to him on the way to the office before, the 8:30 hour.
Yeah.
I know I can get them from the house all the way to the office.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, spread the word because we're back in Santa Fe and Los Alamos. We started today.
And the state of New Mexico looks like we're going to get a voter verified paper ballot election reform here.
Real quick question. What's the name of the theater there in Santa Fe that played The Power of Nightmares?
This was in Albuquerque.
Is it the Guild?
The Guild. Uh-huh.
Okay. Are they going to play it again?
I don't think. Actually, it wasn't the theater that did it.
Oh, they just provided the facility.
Wall-to-walled it.
Yeah, I see.
They rented the whole theater.
Oh, interesting.
And they were showing the Motorcycle Diaries afterwards. We had to clear out so that they could start taking in paying customers.
Right. Interesting.
But they do a good job. So.
Well, Roy, thank you for the update. And
you bet. And have a great one.
Okay.
Take care.
You
Bye.
Too. Do good. 17 minutes before the hour, an Afghan prison stirs doubts on the CIA. Here we are strutting around the world saying, we're bringing democracy to the world. A fine and admirable goal, I might add. One that I entirely support. I am an evangelist for democracy. Read my book, What Would Jefferson Do? There's an entire chapter in there about how if you want world peace, have worldwide democracy, because no two democracies have ever gone to war with each other in history. Why? Because people will not choose to go to war with other people if they have the choice. Very simple. By and large, you could say that the invasion of Iraq perhaps being the exception that proves the rule, but without getting into that. In any case, we're running around the world saying democracy is on the march and we're bringing democracy, blah, 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 blah. And I've got to tell you, the best and most effective way to sell things is not to scare people, it's to entice them. It is not to threaten them, it is to offer them. You will have much more success demonstrating the extraordinary and wonderful quality of life that you can get from living in a democracy, in a truly democratic republic, where you actually have voting that isn't rigged. Oh, let's not go there. You can have more success by living it. You'll have more people wanting to imitate you than by strutting around saying, we're gonna do it for you. It's just very simple. America, as the beacon of democracy for the world, was responsible for about 100 countries becoming democratic in the last 100 years, more or less. The majority of nations in the world now are largely democratic. Not because anybody forced it on them, but because they stole it. They stood up and they said, we want this. We want this. We're going to take this. We're going to get it. And so what does it do to democracy, to the image of democracy around the world, to those idealists in Beijing who walked to prison sentences in Tiananmen Square reciting Thomas Jefferson and carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché replica of the Statue of Liberty? What does it do to the freedom fighters in Burma, who are fighting in Myanmar, who are fighting for democracy in that nation? What does it do for the people in nations that are saddled and stifled with repressive governments? When we send our citizens or when we send our prisoners to places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which are not democracies, to be tortured, what does it do to the image of democracy? What does it do to the image of democracy when we torture people and kill them in secret? This is Pinochet stuff. Remember Augusto Pinochet? The disappeared, the mothers of the disappeared who protested all those years? This from the Boston Globe, Dana Priest's article in the Washington Post. Actually, it was originally published, but the Boston Globe, the copy I have here. In November 2002, a new CIA case officer in charge of a secret prison just north of Kabul allegedly ordered guards to strip an uncooperative Afghan detainee, chain him to the concrete floor, and leave him there overnight without blankets, according to four U.S. government officials who have been made aware of the case. The Afghan guards, paid by the CIA and working under CIA supervision in an abandoned warehouse codenamed the Salt Pit. This is one of our secret prisons around the world. We have a series of these. This one's in Afghanistan. Dragged their captive around on the concrete floor, bruising and scraping his skin before putting him in his cell, two of the officials said, on condition of anonymity. As night fell, so did the temperature, and by morning, the Afghan man had frozen to death. This is Dana Priest's article I'm sharing with you. After a quick autopsy by a CIA medic, hypothermia was listed as the cause of death. The guards buried the man, who was in his 20s, in an unmarked and unacknowledged cemetery used by Afghan forces, officials said. The captive's family has never been notified. His returns have never been returned for burial. He is on no one's registry of captives, not even as a ghost detainee, the term for CIA captives held in military prisons but not registered in the books. As one U.S. government official said, he just disappeared from the face of the earth. The CIA case officer, meanwhile, has been promoted. Promoted. The CIA, Dana Priest continues, the CIA wanted the Salt Pit to be a host nation facility, an Afghan prison with Afghan guards. Its designation as an Afghan facility was intended to give U.S. personnel some insulation from actions taken by Afghan guards. The CIA, however, paid the entire cost of maintaining the facility. The CIA also decided who would be kept inside, including some high-value targets, senior al-Qaeda leaders, in transit to other more secure CIA prisons. You know, it's not just the moral issue of is it right to kill somebody to torture somebody without having a trial and jury of their peers, presented evidence, opportunity to refute it, all that kind of thing. It's not just the moral issue of that. There's a much larger issue here, and that is, what kind of example are we setting for the world? And on top of that, there's an even larger issue than that, and that is that torture doesn't produce good information. If you want to get somebody to go along with you, to tell you what's going on, you don't make them hate you, you make them like you. It's the Stockholm Syndrome. Patty Hearst was abducted by the Symbionese Liberation. Next couple weeks later, she's robbing a bank with them. If you can get your detainees to like you, they will help. This is what we did with the Nazis in World War II. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. I'm Tom Hartman with you. Tim in Illinois with us, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the daily dose of sanity.
There you go. Your minimum daily adult requirement.
I wonder if it might be time for an expose of an outfit called factcheck.org. Perhaps some of your listeners can shed some light on them other than what I know. What I know that this outfit purportedly is a, quote, consumer advocate, end quote, group, which accepts no corporate funding and whose mission is to sort through the political BS and tell Americans the truth.
Yeah, and they're heavily quoted, particularly by CNN, but by many of the news organizations during the election. It was always, okay, here's Bush's ad, here's Kerry's ad, but let's see what factcheck.org has to say.
Yes, and they were used extensively on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Now, the big thing that they're onto now is the argument, their argument, that Social Security privatization would not be a windfall for Wall Street. And they're funded by the Annenberg Foundation, which was created by Walter Annenberg, an enormously wealthy publishing magnate who had close ties to Nixon and Reagan. And, you know, this is one of those things where they're presented as someone who's impartial, who's looking to tell us the truth, and yet,
well,
are these people?
Yeah, hang on just a second, though, Tim. I mean, is Walter Annenberg still alive?
No.
Yeah, see, I mean, the Ford Foundation, Henry Ford was a notorious anti-Semite who you know, his Dearborn newspaper was this, you know, incredible rag. He was a racist. He was in his personal life and his personal opinions, he was horrible. And yet the Ford Foundation does some really extraordinary good stuff. So I'm not, you know, what do you know about the Annenberg Foundation? That's what I would be looking at, not its founder.
Right, but the Annenberg, I'm having trouble finding anything out about the Annenberg Foundation.
Well, just go to their website or look at their annual report. It'll give you a list of everything they fund. They're required to disclose that by law.
Well, this outfit, factcheck.org, is part of it, and they connect themselves with the University of Pennsylvania, and they're in this battle with a progressive site called Campaign for America's Future.
Interesting.
About Social Security privatization.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know how much, you know, if any of Richard Mellon Scaife's money is creeping in there through the University of Pennsylvania. I don't know, Tim, but hopefully you have alerted some of our listeners, and maybe one of them has a blog or something. They'll let us know what's going on with this. I had been under the impression that this was a relatively reasonably unbiased source of information. Of course, there's almost no such thing. I'm Tom Hartman. It's talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade...
Values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we have a British criminal mastermind on his way to the United States. Richard Smith, 23 years old, planning on showing up here in a few months. And the FBI intends to do nothing about it. I'll give you more details on that in a few minutes. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website if you'd like to drop by. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the Democracy Zone, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no police with batons, no loyalty oaths required. You don't have to get a ticket from the Republican Party. None of the normal stuff necessary to see President Bush or Dick Cheney. No siree, Bob. You can simply tune in on your radio to the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome to our show. Oh, my. We've got a couple of calls here. Let's just go right to the phones. Alice in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Okay.
You are live and on
the
air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Alice.
I'm calling you to help make up your mind about Hillary.
Okay.
I have a beautiful picture she sent me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's a very good, caring, and decent person. I would love to see her as our first lady president.
Good. Well, I am not saying I would not love to see that. She certainly would be better than George W. Bush. And perhaps better than the majority of other Democrats out there. I don't know enough about the issues and Hillary's position on them yet to be able to endorse her. But I am certainly not opposed to her.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that.
Well,
Alice,
keep an open mind.
Uh-huh. I certainly will. Thanks.
You think we have a chance for an honest election?
An honest election?
I heard something about a new ballot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
no,
I don't know anything about it.
Well, as long as these electronic voting machines with no paper receipts and no paper trails are out there, and as long as we've got people like Ken Blackwell and Kathleen Harris, political hacks who are running the actual voting process, we're going to have a problem. And we need to do something about that. In my opinion, you know, we need to have an independent group that does exit polls, that keeps people honest. This would be a perfect thing for Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader needs to create the equivalent of the Center for Auto Safety, that group that he created back in the 60s that got us seat belts and then got us cars that don't blow up when they get in car accidents. Somebody needs to create something like that with regard to voting. And until they do, I'm not real optimistic. I have a feeling our voting system is very vulnerable. Alice, thanks for the call. It's great to hear. It's always great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Ed in California is on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, not much. Keep going, Alice.
Yeah, Alice is wonderful, isn't she?
Yeah. I hope I could be that good. I got a question. I was listening to the Meet the Press this weekend. How do we start fighting the fight from the front? They keep telling us that we're the negative people. We're the people who are so negative.
Well, what happened? I was on an airplane on airplanes all day Sunday, so I did not see Meet the Press. Tell me what happened.
Well, you know, just the people talking, and it's hard for me to recall facts, you know, that because of the medications and stuff. But that's the basic message, is, you know, the people on the other side from the cons are just, we need to go back to sleep. And we need to stop this negative fighting. Everything the president does is wonderful. Everything we do is terrible. And how do we stop the Limbaughs and stuff from making us feel that we are the worst people in the world?
Don't listen to them.
Well, I know that. But
it's,
I mean,
it's very simple.
They're
don't
on
listen
every
to
station.
Them.
Every time I turn around,
listen to rock and roll. I mean, the fact of the matter is that I think the influence and impact of these guys is vastly overrated. It's not insignificant, and it has turned elections and it has changed American public opinion to some amount. But it's also, you know, there's 300 some odd million people in America, more or less, and Limbaugh claims an audience of 6 million, and the real number is probably about a third of that. So,
well, they had Helen Caldicott.
Yeah, Helen Caldicott.
On one of the programs.
Yeah.
Very smart, intelligent woman.
She's
you
brilliant.
You could tell when a conservative called up.
Yeah.
Because they're mocking her. They're mocking her thoughts. They don't want to listen. I mean, how do we frame it so that we can...
I don't think we need to do anything slick at all, Ed. I think we just need
to
keep telling
the truth.
No,
I'm not talking about slick. I'm talking about how do we get them to wake up.
Yeah, well, by telling the truth. The American, the issues that I try to do on this program, the issues that actually affect average Americans, the fact that the middle class is being wiped out, that organized labor is under assault, that our environment is under assault from this administration, that the social safety net that provides for democracy is under assault, that without an educated populace, you can't have a democracy, and Bush is trying to take apart all of our educational systems. He's cutting back. I thought it was so ironic last week he gave a speech at a community college about how important community colleges are 2 days after he announced a budget that was going to cut all federal funding for, I think they're called Perkins grants, for these Perkins grants, which are loans for people to go to community colleges and vocational schools. And nobody even pointed that out. Nobody mentioned it. I pointed it out on this program, and I'm sure probably on Air America the folks were talking about it. And that's what we need. We need more voices like that, and we need folks like you, Ed, who are willing to call on those days that you can, you know, slug down a couple shots of whiskey and listen to Limbaugh and call up and say, hey, this is, you know, not that I'm promoting alcohol here, but you've almost got to be medicated to listen to these guys, start speaking the truth. Although increasingly, their call screeners are getting really good on these conservative programs, and they won't let you through. We had last week, last Tuesday, when I filled in for Randy Rhodes, I wanted to get a conservative on to debate. I mean, we're all the time trying to get him on for our program, but I figured, you know, they'd be pleased to come out of the woods for her program, which is on more stations than mine is. And we called the Heritage Foundation, and they said, okay, we got these five people available. And I said, great, we'll take this one. And they call him. No, he doesn't want to do it. Okay, well, here's our second choice. No, he doesn't want to do it. Here's our third choice. No, he won't do it. Here's our fourth. And this was their list for the day. Right. This is the list of people that they were contacting. They were talk shows all across the country and saying, here's the five guys for the day, you know, and none of them would come on. And so, it's like they very much don't want to have that dialogue because they know that we will take them apart. And that's why we just need to keep on telling the truth. And on those occasions when you can get through, write letters to the editors of the newspapers, contact your radio stations, contact your TV stations and get the word out.
There's an old thought. If you want every one of your dreams to come true, wake up.
Yeah, there you go. And get active. Wake up and get active. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Bill from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's great to have you back here.
Thank you.
It seems to me that for a progressive to run nationally, a campaign has got to go for multiple years. I'm not suggesting that the individual candidate works as hard as the candidates do now for like a one-year run, but their organization needs to be multi-year, and it seems to me that they need to have like people on the ground knocking on doors and talking about things that you talk about, you know, like saving jobs and...
Well, the Republicans have been doing this for a couple of decades, and the Democrats now are starting to do it. Howard Dean is starting to do that. And, of course, you know, Bernie Sanders loves to say on this program every Friday, he loves to say, politics is a 365-day-a-year job. And he's not talking about his job. He's talking about your job and my job. That is, if we want to make change happen in the United States, if we want to restore democracy to this country, if we want to take us back to the moral values that this country once was founded on and once stood for, of being a moral force in the world, of standing up against torture, of repudiating poverty, of protecting our citizens, of having workplaces that are healthy, where people can actually get a decent job with a decent pay, put their kids through school, pay for their medical expenses. If we want to go back to those moral values, it's going to require you and me getting active and speaking out, Bill.
Yeah. Didn't you say that you were thinking about having a forum for candidates?
We're kicking around the idea of coaching some candidates on the air. I'm just playing with it. You think it would be a good idea?
That's an excellent idea, Tom.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see where it goes. We got to find some candidates first.
Yeah.
So, Bill, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
And thanks so much for listening to us on KRSN there in Santa Fe, 1490. John in New England on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, hi. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. I'm calling about the four attorneys that are suing Ken Blackwell in Ohio over the fraudulent election this year.
Yeah,
last year.
Our listeners can find out more information about that by going to freepress.org. By the way, yes.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thanks, Tom.
Was that your question?
Yeah, that was it.
Oh, okay.
Freepress.org.
Freepress.org is their website. It's actually a publication that several of them write for. And they have some sort of a defense fund that you can donate to there.
Oh, wonderful.
The whole thing. Bob Fitrakis is there, or however you say it, is kind of the lead guy. He's a very, very good guy.
Okay, good. Press, thank you.
Sure enough. It's out of Columbus, Ohio. It's the Columbus Free Press. So the one-man crime wave heading for the States, this is something we all need to worry about. This is going to be tough. This guy, his name, Richard Smith. Now, if that doesn't sound like a phony name to me, I'll tell you. But he claims that's his real name. He's coming to the United States, and his avowed goal is to break a law in pretty much every state in the Union on his summer vacation. For example, in Utah, he intends to hunt whales. It's against the law in Utah to hunt whales. He's going to do it. In Jonesboro, Georgia, in public, he's going to say, oh, boy. Yes, it's illegal in Jonesboro, Georgia. In Albany, New York, he's going to play golf on the street. In Miami, he's going to break the law. He's going to appear wearing a strapless gown. It's against the law in Miami to wear strapless gowns. This is pretty dangerous stuff here, this guy. He's coming over here explicitly. You think, I wonder if they'll stop him at customs. Because he's coming over here, he's saying his entire mission, the whole point of his coming over here, is to break the laws of America. He said there's a law in Florida that forbids widows from going parachuting on Sundays. Unfortunately, he's not a widow. He can't break that law. But, you know, he's got some pretty good ones. In Oxford, Mississippi, it's illegal to drive around the town square more than 100 times on a single occasion. He figures that one's going to take him a little bit of time. And in South Dakota, he's got a bit of a challenge. He's trying to find a cheese factory in which he can fall asleep, because it's against the law to fall asleep in a cheese factory in South Dakota. So we'll see. We'll see if he can do it. The article is from the Cox News Service by Shelley Emling, One Man Crime Wave Heading for the United States. When it comes to the summer's adventure, Smith said that one of the states he's sure to avoid is Texas. You keep in mind, George W. Bush executed children while he was governor of that state, and he executed mentally retarded people while he was governor of that state. Two things that the Supreme Court has since said are wrong. I find it interesting that both times the Supreme Court ruled on those two things, nobody mentioned the fact that Bush had done those. But in any case, he says he's not going to Texas. He says, they have the death penalty down in Texas. That place kind of makes me nervous. So I guess Texas can breathe a big sigh of relief. Richard Smith is not going to fall asleep in a cheese factory in Texas or hunt whales in landlocked Utah. 18,000 mile journey he's going to take to break the laws of America. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need?
Welcome back. Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs.
But he's got a scheme
every
here.
Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, because I always wanted me one that was long and black.
And there's got to be a way to get one.
One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand.
A piece at a time, yeah.
Now, getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time.
See, that's how you have to do top politics.
You know it's me when I come through your town.
Yes, it's the great Johnny Cash. One piece at a time. That's how we have to do politics. Infiltrate the Republican Party, those of you who are inclined in that direction. Infiltrate the Democratic Party, those of you inclined in that direction. Let's bring integrity. Let's bring political action. Let's bring the voices of we the people back into politics. Get involved in the Green Party. Get involved in the Libertarian Party. Pick your party. Yeah, you can even do two at a time, I suppose. But get involved. get out there and do some. Check out the Democracy for America meetups. They're still having them all over the country. And I'm continually amazed. I travel around the country on these speaking gigs from time to time. How many people tell me that, oh, I'm here because I heard about you at the meetup. What meetup? Well, we all get together on the second Thursday of every month or whatever it is. I think they're all always Wednesdays, first Wednesday of the month or something like that. And I've attended the one here in Vermont, although unfortunately I'm not able to go every single month, but good stuff, good stuff. A rule change lets the CIA freely send suspects. Oh, by the way, speaking of our one-man crime wave, Richard Smith, Rama, during the break, Rama Schneider's in engineering the program for us today, and Rama does a Google search during the break and comes up. Now 26 U.S. states have different versions of a three strikes and you're outlaw, and there is also an overriding but little used federal three strikes law. So somebody better let Mr. Smith know that if he falls asleep in a cheese factory and he says, "Hoo boy," and he wears a strapless gown in Miami, that's three strikes. He could be in federal prison for the rest of his life. We don't mess around with criminals here in the United States. And not just federal prison, but a federal prison. He could be in a prison run by a private corporation, making all of the stockholders a little extra. Maybe it's time to buy some stock in prison corporations, as this guy's bringing his crime wave here. Anyway, speaking of crime waves, the CIA is, there's been this rule change. The Bush administration, this is from the New York Times, article by Douglas Gell and David Johnston. Bush administration's secret program to transfer suspected terrorists to foreign countries for interrogation. It turns out that Bush signed some sort of a finding or a rule or whatever that allowed them to do that without case-by-case approval, which is what was necessary under the Clinton administration and previous administrations. This is called rendition. You've heard of it, extraordinary rendition. I always thought rendering was, you know, making soap or out of fat or something. But, you know, this is a... In recent weeks, several former detainees have described being subjected to coercive interrogation techniques and brutal treatment during months spent in detention under the program in Egypt and other countries. Yes, freedom is on the march, except in those countries where they torture people and they don't have democracies, and we're going to send prisoners there so they can do our dirty work for us. But we're the example for the world. Please do what we do. You know, this dissonance is not lost on the rest of the world. Maybe the average American hasn't figured it out, but the rest of the world is looking at this going, so that's what democracy is all about. Not sure we want that. The CIA has flown 100 to 150 suspected terrorists from one foreign country to another, including Egypt, Syria. Syria! We got Syria torturing people for us, and we're yelling at them. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Pakistan. Each of those countries has been identified by the State Department as habitually using torture in its prisons. Then they actually have the stories of three guys who were not charged with any crimes. They were all released. They were all innocent. One was tortured for a year. One was tortured for 5 months. One was tortured for 40 months. Electric shocks, beatings, drugs. What have we done?
But, Dad...
Tyler, we've been over this three times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
But the whole class is invited.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy. But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
You are so stubborn.
No.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers.
Time to get a move on.
Yeah, tell that to Richard Smith. I just can't get over that. And he doesn't know that we've got a federal three strikes law. Incredible. Greetings to the folks in our chat room, by the way. Some interesting conversations there. You can drop by tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Actually, it'll get you over to the message board, then click live chat and drops you in. You may have to hold down the control key if it's your first visit before you click the register button so it pops open a separate window if you have pop-up suppression. Not that it's going to pop up an ad at you, but it pops up a window for you to fill in your, you know, your name and password and stuff. And so, anyhow, who are the real terrorists? We got a call earlier from, I believe it was Bill in Santa Fe, or it might have been Roy and Rio Rancho. One of our New Mexico listeners called in and pointed out that in Albuquerque there was a station, or a theater that played The Power of Nightmares, which is this three-hour BBC documentary that played just in October and then again last month on the BBC. And the basic thesis of A Power of Nightmares is that the whole hype, the whole terrorism thing, while it's real, there are people who want to, you know, blow up dirty bombs or who want to kill us or, you know, blah, blah, blah. We have people who view us the way the IRA viewed England for years and years. That it's being hyped to high heaven for political purposes, both in the United States and the United Kingdom. And you think about that for a minute. You know, yes, this is real. This is something we need to do something about. Certainly, there are. I mean, consider if the terrorists came over here and kidnapped the president, God forbid, and killed him, God forbid. Well, this is what actually happened in Italy. Aldo Moro, remember that? Some of you are probably old enough to remember. It was in the 70s, as I recall, the late 70s. The Red Brigades kidnapped the Prime Minister of Italy and killed him. Stuffed him in the trunk of a car. I don't remember if they shot him or he died of suffocation or what the deal was, but I remember he died in the trunk of a car, or they found him. They found his body in the trunk of a car. And what, did Italy declare war on terror? It's the Red Brigades. We're going to declare war on them. No, they said, these guys are criminals. They're thugs. They're evil, mean, terrible, maniacal, stupid, insane people. We are going to track them down and put them in jail. And they did. In fact, there's a trial going on this week of one of the very last of them. It's taken a few years. But they got him. And what happened as soon as the government of Italy said, you know, these people are criminals. They're trying to destroy our society. They're trying to harm our society. This is wrong what they've done. And framed it in a moral context. Then the people of Italy turned against the Red Brigades. And people who had been members of the Red Brigade started turning themselves in and saying, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm sorry. I apologize. And people who were friends of people who were in the Red Brigade started turning their friends in. Because people got it. This is sick. It was the same thing that happened in the United States when we had a terrorist incident here. The largest terrorist incident, you know, outside of the Civil War, things that happened during the Civil War, outside of that, the largest terrorist incident, domestic terrorism, you know, within the borders of the United States, in history, when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And Bill Clinton didn't go on TV and say, there's terrorists in our midst. We have to be frightened. There's a terror alert. It's orange now. Look out. We need to create whole departments for this, and we need more money for this. And no, he said, these guys are criminals. And what happened? The people that they thought would hide them started turning them in. They're criminals. You strip them of any moral authority when you define them as criminals, as outside the mainstream, as not evildoers, just thugs. Pathetic thugs. But if you declare a war against them, then you elevate them essentially to your own status. Because you declare wars on peers. We didn't declare a war on Grenada, for example. We simply went in and took out the guy. You know, I'm not saying that I agree with it. I frankly didn't at the time. But nonetheless, let's say it was the right thing to do, just for purposes of discussion. Which, I don't think it was. But just for example, in any case, Reagan didn't declare a war on Grenada. He simply said, you know, this guy, we're not going to. These American medical students are in trouble. Now, it turns out they weren't. Reagan lied to us about it, all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, you declare war on, like, a nation the size of you. It adds legitimacy to people when you declare a war on them. In fact, Louise and I were in Grenada just a couple of years after that. Yeah. It's a pretty decent place. You ever get to Grenada, be sure to go to the Nutmeg Cafe. It's right on the main street there, the second floor bar where you can sit there and drink these incredible rum drinks until you can hardly, well, you don't, I need not go any farther. Anyhow, terrorists, to define a terrorist as having the status of a nation state is to elevate them, and that's what we have done with Osama bin Laden. We have made him a hero around the world. And on 9/11, the entire world was looking at what bin Laden did, assuming that bin Laden actually did it. And I think that that's a fairly safe assumption. The entire world was looking at this and going, oh, my God, this is a horrible thing. There was a candlelight vigil in Tehran, Iran. The French, the Le Monde, the headline, we are all Americans now. People from all over the world were sharing their empathy and concern with us. And if we had simply said, you know, these people are criminals, we would like the world, we would like Interpol, and we would like the police agencies of the world to help us track them down. And when we went to the Taliban, when we went to Afghanistan, to the Taliban government that George W. Bush had just given $54 million to in exchange for them growing fewer opium poppy crops, when we went to that government and we said, would you please give us Osama bin Laden so we can bring him to trial? They said, we are willing to turn him over. We are willing to do that. Not to the United States, but to any other country, any, you know, where he'll get a fair trial. We're not sure he'll get a fair trial with you guys. There's a little too much hysteria going on. But we will arrest him and turn him over. And George W. said, nope, that's not good enough. We're going to bomb you. And now democracy's on the march, although the women are back in burqas, and Afghanistan just produced the largest opium poppy crop in the history of the world. We have now the largest heroin problem in the history of the world as a result of this narco state. But I digress. What I wanted to talk about was, who are the real terrorists? Here we've got an American judge whose husband and mother were just murdered. And Matt Hale, the white supremacist, he's sitting in a Chicago jail cell. Why do they call this guy a white supremacist instead of a terrorist? Why is it that if they're white and Christian, they're not terrorists? Can somebody explain this to me? The World Church of the Creator has been linked to some of the, I'm quoting now from the San Francisco Chronicle, the World Church of the Creator has been linked to some of the most vicious and brutal hate crimes in recent years, including a spate of synagogue fires in Sacramento and the murder of a gay couple in Shasta County 6 years ago. Why do we not call them terrorists? Or on the other hand, why do we not call the people that we're calling terrorists right now criminals? Which, frankly, I think is the more rational course. Could it be that George W. doesn't want to alienate his white Christian base by calling white Christian criminals terrorists, and that it's a whole lot easier to terrify the bejesus out of Americans and put us on a state of alert where we're willing to give up our liberties? We're willing to say, okay, the Fourth Amendment, it doesn't matter anymore. We can do sneak and peek searches without warrants. Yeah, the founders, you know, they had that nice idea that people should be, you know, secure in their persons and effects and houses, but that was quaint, to quote Alberto Gonzalez, speaking about the Geneva Conventions, of course. That's quaint. Who are the real terrorists? This is a discussion that I really think we need to be having in the United States. This group, they had 88 chapters across the country. Now we know that they have 16 chapters around the country. Are they terrorists? They're killing people. They're terrorizing people. But they're white Christians. So somehow I suspect that you're not going to hear George W. referring to them as terrorists. Speaking of Afghanistan, this from the AFP, Afghanistan's narcotics trade is a major threat to global stability, the U.S. has warned in its annual report on drug trafficking. This falls into the category of right hand, left hand, right? One part of the U.S. government is saying that Afghanistan has become a narco-terror state. That former Unocal oil executive, the company that wanted to build the gas pipeline across Afghanistan, you'll recall, you know, where Dick Cheney back in 98 said, you know, you can have a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, the former Unocal, as I recall, it's Unocal oil executive and or consultant, Hamid Karzai, now the president of Afghanistan, by coincidence, doesn't even control the entire city of Kabul. And there's two other towns he has partial control. No control whatsoever of the countryside. And we're not, you know, making the same military mistake we are in Afghanistan that we are in Iraq, which is trying to control the whole country. We've only got, what, 12,000, 13,000 troops there. And the women are back in the burqas. The opium poppies are growing again. And on the one hand, George W. will tell you, oh, freedom's on the march. We've created a democracy. Isn't it wonderful? Look at all these people came out to vote. What he won't tell you is that everywhere except in downtown Kabul, they were voting because the narco-terrorists paid them to vote for the local warlords. So anyhow, here on the other hand, you've got the State Department on last Friday, released a report saying that Afghanistan's cultivation of opium has tripled since we have helped with the administration of that nation to an all-time high in 2004 of 206,700 hectares. That's 510,000 acres under poppy cultivation in Afghanistan right now, and we're simply letting it happen. Last year, Afghanistan produced 4,950 tons of opium. Now, the second largest producer of opium in the world is what used to be called Burma. They call it now Myanmar. One of the world's ugliest dictatorships. Afghanistan produced 17 times more opium than did Burma, Myanmar. These two countries account for 90% of the world's opium and thus heroin. 90% of the heroin in the world is coming out of Burma and Afghanistan produced 17 times more than Burma. Now, if I'm doing my math right, that means that something like 86% of the world's narcotics are coming out of Afghanistan, which is supposed to be where freedom's on the march! Let me just quote you from the State Department, the U.S. State Department. Afghan poppies, once the mainstay of the Taliban regime, have become the principal source of heroin for the international underworld and potentially help groups opposed to Afghan's democratic government. It's out of control now. The heroin trade, the drug trade, the opium trade in Afghanistan now represents 60% of that country's entire GDP. The economy of the country, 60% of it. Narcotics. I mean, everybody's, oh, Colombia, they're making all that cocaine in Peru, and it's nothing. 5%, 3%, 60% Afghanistan. The country where we have brought freedom on the march. As I said, I salute George Bush's language of spreading democracy around the world. I think it's a marvelous goal. And I believe the most effective way to spread democracy around the world is to be a shining light, a beacon of democracy for the world, to demonstrate how democracy should work. And that means having open, free, and fair elections here in the United States. It means having a free and open press here in the United States. It means having the will of the people determine policy rather than the will of corporate lobbyists here in the United States. It means kicking out the bought and paid for politicians of both parties, and replacing them with people who are willing to respond to the needs of we the people so that we can clean up our air and our water and our soil and our food supply can be safe. And we can have rational trade policies that don't destroy the middle class in the name of enhancing the profits of multinational corporations who have no loyalty to this country at all. Let's bring democracy to America first. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Len. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
And welcome back. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. I'm Tom Hartman. The bankruptcy bill is currently wending its way, as they euphemistically say, through Congress. Article here in the Washington Monthly by Kevin Drum, titled The Bankruptcy Bill. There have been a few attempts. Now, again, the bankruptcy bill, I told you the story earlier, sitting next to this guy on the plane on my way back from San Diego, who was an executive with one of the credit card companies. I'm not going to identify the company, but in any case, he talking about how they're making all their money on fees and interest and all this kind of stuff. And I said, boy, I'll bet you guys are looking forward to this bankruptcy bill. And he said, we sure are. We've been lobbying for it for a decade. Well, here are a few amendments that people have tried to attach to the bill that, you know, to change the bill. Number one, Russ Feingold, what he's a Democrat of Wisconsin, I believe. He put on an amendment that would have allowed senior citizens to protect $75,000 of the value of their homes during bankruptcy proceedings. The Republicans said, no, can't have that on there. Sorry. Senior citizens cannot protect $75,000 of the value of their homes. Tough luck, old farts. You are out of luck. So Ted Kennedy puts in an amendment focused on helping people who are forced into bankruptcy due to major medical expenses. And the conservatives, I shouldn't just say Republicans, because there are Democrats who are in bed with these folks as well. Just fewer of them numerically. Let's say the conservatives said, no, sorry, even though the majority of bankruptcies now are caused by people having medical bills they can't pay for, unforeseen medical bills that have wiped them out, we're not going to put any kind of exemption in here that says that if somebody has to declare bankruptcy because one of their kids got cancer or something and they can't afford the $200,000 in treatment, that they can declare bankruptcy. Sorry. They're going to be in indentured servitude for the rest of their lives. Sorry, Ted Kennedy. Go away. Also from Ted Kennedy, an amendment that would have protected $150,000 of the value of patients' homes. This, again, people who are being hit by medical bills, that up to $150,000 of their home. And I'm telling you, there are parts of this country, like San Diego, where I was this last weekend, where $150,000 is like the back bedroom. And the Republicans and the conservative Democrats said, nope, sorry. We're not going to let people keep any part of their homes, even if they're losing them because of medical bills. Daniel Akaka, the senator from Hawaii, added an amendment to force credit card companies to disclose how long it will take a consumer to pay off his bill, making minimum monthly payments and what the interest rate will be. No, they're not going to add that either. What loopholes have they left in the bill? Well, the bill does nothing to address the growing use of what are called asset protection trusts used by rich people to shield income from bankruptcy proceedings so Ken Lay can declare bankruptcy and still walk away with millions, or to rein in the unlimited use of homestead exemptions, which in Florida and Texas allow multimillionaires to shield tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars from bankruptcy in the bankruptcy courts. Millionaires walk. The rest of us, we're toast. That's Bush World. Welcome to Bush World. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it.